Germany scoring in the second half of its game against the U.S. soccer team at the World Cup today. And that was the only goal of the game. The U.S. lost, but it wins anyway. And that's because of what happened in another game. USA has enough overall points to move into the next round in the World Cup. Matthew Futterman is a sports reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and he joins us now from Recife in Brazil, where the game was played. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing there?
I'm great. Well, for those of us who didn't get to watch the game, the U.S. lost 1-0. How would you characterize it? It was played in very rainy conditions.
Yeah, it was kind of a deluge here on the northeast coast of Brazil. It's a rainy area this time of year, and the flooding on the way to the stadium was really massive. I mean, some roads had a couple feet of water on them, and the game started in a massive downpour. But then I'd say about 25 minutes in, it lightened up and became pretty playable. At the same time, it seemed to, well, it might have slowed the U.S. down a little bit. It did not slow the Germans down, who had just a massive attack on the U.S. and held the ball for something like 63% of the game, if you believe those sorts of statistics. But they only got one goal, and since it was a narrow loss for the U.S. and a narrow win for Portugal, the U.S. goes on to the knockout rounds.
Yeah, so Portugal beat Ghana 2-1 today at the same time. So tell us about how this works now. So the U.S. and Germany now go forward?
They do go forward. 32 teams start. There's 8 groups of 4. They play a round robin within those groups. You get 3 points for a win, 1 point for a draw, no points for a loss. But then there's a series of tiebreakers for teams that end up with the same amount of points as the U.S. and Portugal did. They both ended up with 4 points. But the first tiebreaker is goal differential. So how many goals you score compared with how many goals you let in. The U.S. had a goal differential had an even goal differential, and Portugal had a goal differential of, I believe, -2. So the U.S. goes through on that one. And, you know, a lot of people would think the U.S. really deserved to go through anyway. They were about to beat Portugal the other night and clinch a spot in the knockout round. Portugal scored sort of a miracle last-second goal that kept them alive.
Yeah. Well, there was some talk, and I don't know if this is legal or not under FIFA rules, but some talk that the German and the U.S. team would conspire to play to a draw, because then both would be sure to go through that way. But obviously that didn't happen. Would that have been illegal under FIFA rules?
I mean, if you make a deal like that, and it's illegal and it's frowned upon, and it sort of goes against the ideas of sport. Does it happen? Yeah, sure, it happens. Did it happen today? I don't think it really happened today. And that's sort of the nature of the German team, just by the way they play. They don't sit back. They attack. Their defense is really to play offense constantly, which makes for a very dangerous situation. If you're a team like the U.S. and you're trying to guarantee passage with a draw, it's just much more difficult to pull off.
Yeah, and so speaking of that, it is still surprising to many people that the U.S. has gotten as far as it has.
Yeah, they were in what is considered the group of death. I mean, you've had 32 teams here, and they're divided into 8 groups of 4, but because of the draw, which is a somewhat random situation, they ended up with Germany, which is the number 2 ranked team in the world, and Portugal, which is the number 4 ranked team in the world, and Ghana, which is probably the best team in Africa, which has booted the U.S. from the World Cup the last 2 tournaments. That's about as tough as, I think that might be statistically the toughest group in the history of the World Cup.
So it is
quite an accomplishment that they survived.
And so Portugal and Ghana are out?
Portugal and Ghana go home. Yeah,
okay.
Those two teams sort of imploded. Portugal had a loss, its opening game 4-0 to Germany, which was really the difference maker. Its star defender Pepe sort of lost his mind early on and headbutted an opponent, and he was suspended. He was thrown out of that game and suspended for another game, and that really sort of provided the opening for Portugal to collapse when no one really expected them to.
Okay, so the U.S. moves on, and who are they going to play next and when?
They're going to play either Belgium or Algeria. I think most people would bet that Belgium is going to be the team, that they're going to win their group, and those two teams are going to meet next week. Whoever is pulling the other side of the ball, the U.S. is going to play next week in Salvador. They'll go back tonight or this afternoon to Sao Paulo to their base camp, spend a couple days training and recovering there, and then it's on to Salvador.
Yeah, there was some talk during the game today that the U.S. was still exhausted from its game against Portugal and may have not played as well as it could have given that. Is that a problem going forward for the U.S., that it's now becoming a little bit more of a relentless pace?
Well, it's relentless, but there's nothing more relentless in modern soccer right now than the German team. I mean, maybe Argentina is better. Brazil on its home soil is going to be tough to beat. But, I mean, Germany is widely considered just the class of the sport right now. So I don't want to say it gets easier at this point because it's win or go home, even though today was win or draw or go home for the win or draw or hope for or hope and pray for something good to happen being done in Portugal or go home. But Belgium is definitely a step down from Germany. So if you can survive Germany 1-0, you certainly take your chances against even a team like Belgium.
Right. And so going forward now into round two, who are the favorites aside from Germany?
The Netherlands has been just absolutely wiped out in this tournament. They are fast, they're aggressive, they're speedy. They have Arjen Robben, who seems to be, and Robin van Persie, who seems to be able to just score at will for the most part. So I think a lot of people have their eyes on Germany and the Netherlands going very far in this tournament. At the same time, you have a couple teams from South America. A European team has never won the World Cup in South America. So you got to keep an eye on Argentina, the host team, Brazil, and Chile has been very impressive so far as well.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And have fun.
We'll do our best. It is Brazil, so you don't have to try very hard.
That is for sure. Matthew Futterman, sports reporter for The Wall Street Journal. The industry grew up in Southern California because of our sunny weather and the diverse landscape, but production fled in the last 20 years because of cheaper labor and tax incentives elsewhere. According to state lawmakers, of the 42 big budget features released in the last 2 years, only one was shot exclusively in California. And thanks to New York's generous tax incentives, more TV drama pilots are now being filmed there than in LA for the first time. The state's been wringing its hands for years over what to do about what's called runaway production, but now a bill in Sacramento is trying to fix all that. Ted Johnson covers the intersection of politics and entertainment for Variety, and he joins us now to explain what's up in Sacramento. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, tell us what the current incentive program is.
The current program, it's $100 million a year. Sounds like a hefty figure. And film productions and certain TV shows can apply for up to 20% credit against their production budget. And what happens is they get a certificate that allows them to put that credit up against their income and sales and use taxes on their tax returns. So that's essentially, in a nutshell, how the program works. However, there's a lot of paperwork involved, as you mm-hmm. would expect.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's basically a lottery system, and then if you don't get in, you don't get the incentives?
Yes. California is a little different from other states in that it does have a lottery. The reason it was set up that way is from the first year that this program started, there was an expectation that the demand is going to greatly outstrip supply, and that's exactly what happened. They thought this was the fairest approach that they could take, as opposed to first come, first serve would probably create some controversies along the way.
But why not give it to everybody, a tax incentive to everybody?
Well, California is in a unique position, especially when they compete against other states. Essentially, other states are setting their programs up to take production away from California. And even though we've had a diminishment in the number of production days and production jobs from its peak in the 90s, California is still the movie capital of the world. It's not what it once was. So if you're going to do away with this lottery and just give it to whoever qualifies, I've been told that you would probably have to have about a $1 billion program, and that is probably pretty politically infeasible when you look to Sacramento.
Right, right. So what is feasible? What's being proposed right now?
Well, right now, what they're trying to do is, first of all, capture productions that have really fled. One is big-budget feature films. You mentioned that earlier. There's right now, in the current program, a cap. No movie above $75 million budget can actually apply to the program. They're going to lift that cap. The other is to capture more of these one-hour drama series, which are really big job creators. They always say middle-class jobs, but also some pretty upper-middle-class jobs as well. What they're going to try to do is expand the eligibility. Right now, only basic cable dramas can qualify for the tax credit. They're going to make it so almost every type of one-hour drama series can actually be eligible for the credit.
So basically they're trying to expand the pool of productions that are eligible for this tax break. And is anyone pushing back saying that we shouldn't be doing that?
Well, there's a few people. The California Teachers Association has been pretty much opposed to this tax credit program for years, and they are opposed to this legislation as well. They're arguing that, it's not just the movie industry, it's other industries that have gotten the tax credit, and why are we giving money away from the general fund at the same time when we're really feeling the pinch to education? The bill just went through the Senate, State Senate Governance and Finance Committee yesterday, and that's chaired by Senator Lois Wolk from Northern California. She has also been a critic of the program, but yesterday she didn't do anything to try to stop it. In fact, the vote was, I think it was 4-0. She just abstained from it, and her reason was the legislation right now it doesn't actually have a dollar figure attached to it. That remains to come. I mentioned that the current program is about $100 million a year. There's a push to try to be something comparable to New York's program, which is about $420 million a year. We'll see, if that actually flies in California. So I would expect that a figure will be in this legislation maybe by August.
And then is there any evidence that the state would get its money back in terms of tax receipts from the people working on these productions that would stay in California who would not otherwise?
Yes, this is where the big controversy happens in terms of this legislation, probably not just in California, but in other states. It's kind of a battle of the different studies. You have groups like the Milken Institute, the L.A. County Economic Development Corporation. They've all done studies, and they've come up with figures that California not only gets its money back, but it has substantial economic growth due to these incentives. The figures, can run, $1.10 to $1.50. I mean, different studies tend to come up with different results. However, the legislative analyst examined this legislation and was a little more skeptical about how much money is actually returned. Kind of suggested that at best the state was just kind of breaking even, maybe even losing money a little bit. However, which is probably a victory for supporters, the analyst said, yes, this may not be the best public policy. It may be kind of a race to the bottom, But it's kind of reasonable, given what all these other states are doing, if you want to really make a mark on retaining and maybe luring back some of these jobs.
You know, even Governor Schwarzenegger, he was an actor, a producer, back to being an actor, was slow to push through a change to improve the incentives. It's been very hard to get this through in Sacramento. Is it because of the loss of Toyota and Occidental to Texas? Did that help push along this legislation?
Yes, that helped. I think it also helped Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. He made this as one of the issues on the top of his agenda, and even though he doesn't really have any sway over what happens in Sacramento, he appointed a film czar, and I think that that probably helped to instill a sense of urgency on the situation. And because it had gotten to the point where, almost to the point of ridiculousness, the number of states that are also offering incentives in the job loss. And I think when he was running for mayor, he probably constantly ran into people from the film industry who talked anecdotally about jobs loss or having to go to other states to actually find work.
Ted Johnson covers politics and entertainment for Variety. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, have you lost a job to runaway production? Or maybe you think tax incentives for the studios are just corporate welfare that won't benefit the little guy? Let us know what you think at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. And we might use your call on the air later in the show. You can also weigh in on Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. Coming up, unraveling the allure of a Norwegian author's 3,500-page memoir, Why Karl Ove Knausgård Has Captivated Readers Across the World. That story next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The literary sensation this summer is a dark, brooding writer from Norway who has written an opus called My Struggle. My Struggle is 6 autobiographical books, the third of which has just been published here in the U.S. The books are a fictionalized memoir that detail every detail of Karl Ove Knausgård's life. It can be excruciatingly boring reading, and yet many, many people have found the books impossible to put down. Knausgård recently spoke with our own Michael Silverblatt, and Michael's here now to talk about the books and why Knausgård is such an unlikely literary phenomenon. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
So these books, they've been bestsellers in Norway, translated into some 22 languages worldwide. Critics here in the U.S. just raving.
They're
raving.
They're falling apart.
What is it? Describe what these 6 books are.
Okay. There's a hook. First of all, My Struggle in Norwegian is Min Kampf. Mein Kampf.
Hitler's autobiography.
So people go, oh, who would dare that? And the books are attempts to say, in my daily life, I have suffered an awful life and I've had to climb to serenity. My father, he hit me. My wife, she left me. I don't know how to be a father to my children. What I do know is how to write down what I've lived. And he does it for 6 volumes. And you just go, that's my life. He may be living in Norway. He may be out on a fjord. But my God, he's captured the essence of life. You might be bored from time to time when he's folding the baby diapers, but this is about life. We want to hear someone who will tell us things about our lives that will make it our lives, our own lives, worth living. And by the time you're done, you feel, I love life.
Even though he is portraying a very, very dark and sad life.
Survival. He tells me that he's reading his daughter's Little House on the Prairie. Why? It's a story of survival. As he says about the books, nothing happens in them, but my daughters love them. It's day-to-day survival, and it makes life feel important.
I think that's interesting, because when we think about our current lives right now, they're so fast. The media just comes at us all the time, and we have to just think and act very quickly. And reading this, you're really forced to slow down. Six volumes, 3,500 pages. It's
slow down,
it's a
and
lot.
Smell the roses, even if there are thorns.
What was interesting listening to him speak to you was when he basically seemed still, even years after he became very popular in Norway, a bit surprised that these books have become such phenomena. And in fact, he said he wrote them as a way really to survive, because his life had become, in his estimation, so meaningless. And I just want to play a little clip of him in the interview with you.
I am never present, and my presence is never rich. I'm always somewhere else, you know. And we are surrounded by things or events that go take place another place, you know. We see images and pictures and movies and news and read papers, and everything is going on somewhere else. And this kind of virtual life that becomes more and more, taking more and more place in our lives, I wanted kind of to fight that back. But the irony of this is, of course, I do it in a novel, which is, you know, virtual and not real.
And so for him, was it writing these books, and he calls them novels, which is also interesting, because they seem to be memoirs, but they are novels. How fictionalized are they?
Very good question. His uncle is suing him. His ex-wife staged a radio interview with him. His current wife has had a nervous breakdown. This is a book that's having direct effects on his family. He feels terribly, terribly guilty, but he was in the project of taking life back from the media, from all of our distractions. He wants to feel not half alive, but fully alive. And he's having trouble. He has children. What will it be like when they read these books? And he's trying to be a better father than his father was to him. He's trying to be able to explain. And his wife is very much on his side. But God, to have that level of revelation. You're naked in public. They've moved to Sweden. They don't live in Norway anymore. They've, in a sense, had to flee from the effects of his imaginative writing.
He wrote an interesting essay recently that was published in the New York Times about fame and Norway's complicated relationship with it, that the culture there is not to stick out and not to be better than anyone else. And maybe that's good in terms of social welfare, but for him, he always chafed at that, he said, as a child and I guess now as an adult.
Well, you see, as you read it, one of the things that's so universal, he's listening to the same bands we listened to when we were kids. He's growing up with music and with rock stars, and he's yearning, in a sense, like any writer does, I want to be a rock star. And this man is fantastically attractive. I haven't seen a writer as handsome as he, but because he grew up in a small place with a father who was randomly abusing him, he really doesn't know. When people stare at him, he looks away. People at a reading he gave, man, woman, and dog, they were all hot for Nausgaard. I haven't seen anything like it before. And he's writing the life of someone. Can I be a hero? A hero just with an ordinary life? Can I make what I live through a model for life itself? It's a tremendous ambition, narcissistic and bizarre, but very beautiful, because all of us feel, don't we? What is our life about? What are we doing it for? Day after day after day of it, how do we stay alive? Mm. And he's saying we stay alive by writing it and believing that what we do is important.
Even if it's just folding diapers.
Even when we're folding diapers, yes. We're thinking about something. There's something to be salvaged in writing. It's fascinating.
Michael Silverblatt is host of KCRW's Bookworm, and you can hear part one of his interview with Karl Ove Knausgård today at 2:30, right here on 89.9 KCRW. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the short but influential life of internet wunderkind Aaron Swartz. He committed suicide a year and a half ago as he was fighting the government over downloading files. A new documentary explores the life of Aaron Swartz and how his ideas for an open internet have carried on. After this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Profound sense of loss tonight in Highland Park, Aaron Swartz's hometown, as loved ones say goodbye to one of the internet's brightest lights.
And open access and computer activists are mourning his loss.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A year and a half ago, Aaron Swartz committed suicide. He was 26 years old. Maybe his name doesn't ring a bell, but people in the tech community were devastated. And they've turned Aaron into somewhat of a martyr. They see him as a guy who fought for a free and open internet against a government that hounded him to his death. In his short life, Aaron Swartz profoundly affected how we use and think about the internet. When he was just a teenager, he came up with a prototype Wikipedia and he helped create RSS feeds. He went on to co-found the website Reddit and the nonprofit Creative Commons. But Swartz is best known for his activism around making web files more freely available to the public. His biggest victory came 2 years ago when he helped organize protests that killed a Hollywood-backed online piracy bill called SOPA. But during that time, Swartz was fighting a government indictment, an indictment that may have led to prison time. Filmmaker Brian Knappenberger has made a documentary about Swartz's life and legacy. It's called The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz. And the film opens in theaters and online tomorrow. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, start at the beginning, because he did come from a very intellectually engaged and precocious family.
That's
true. He was one of three boys. But he really stood out.
Yeah, he really did. He took to the internet right away. He took to programming right away. We have stories from his family that he was reading by age three, and he was clearly, you know, we have video of him playing around on the internet from a very, very young age.
Working at the computer?
Mommy, why is nothing working?
But he was clearly, you know, engaged in this notion of free information, this kind of free culture movement, and was contributing substantively to these early groups, as you mentioned, RSS Working Group. There's a funny part in the film where he's been working with this group for over a year, and they say, you know, we'd love for you to come out to one of these face-to-face meetings. Come talk about this in person. And he has to say, actually, I'm not quite sure my mom will let me. I'm only 13 years old. And so, you know, of course, they're number one, they're shocked. And number two, now, of course, they really want to meet him.
Right, right. And so tell us, for those of us who aren't quite conversant, RSS is...
RSS feeds, essentially, the best example of this is a blog where, mm-hmm. you know, you subscribe to someone's RSS update. It feeds the kind of latest headlines or podcasts or whatever to somebody's blog. It's that sort of way of automatically pulling down the kind of latest headlines and sort of consolidating them in one place.
So not unlike Reddit, which he then went on to co-found and became extremely popular, is extremely popular.
Yeah, Reddit is one of the, you know, maybe the most popular social news site in the world.
And so Reddit gets bought out by Condé Nast.
That's right.
And he goes to work there and he thinks, oh my gosh, this is not for me. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a real turning point for him. And how old is he?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, you know, the sale of Reddit to Condé Nast makes him a very rich 19-year-old. And I think that is a turning point. Instead of staying on that kind of Silicon Valley startup treadmill, that path that is really sort of about building to flip and just doing it again, you know, starting another company and
just
selling
doing
it
to make money.
And just doing it to make money.
He wasn't interested in that?
He really decisively makes this turn towards social justice issues, towards using his skills, putting his skills into the public interest, towards using these kinds of his sort of organizing abilities, his kind of talents for political organizing. And he's incredibly successful at it. He branches into a whole range of kind of other pursuits.
It's not enough to just live in the world as it is, to just kind of take what you're given and, you know, follow the things that adults told you to do and that, you know, your parents told you to do and that society tells you to do. Once I realized that there were real serious problems, fundamental problems that I could do something to address, I didn't see a way to forget that. I didn't see a way not to.
So what does he do next? He decides to shun the whole Silicon Valley culture and get into this activism, as you say.
Yeah, so he does a thing called the Open Library, which is about you know, cataloging books, every book that's been created. He actually becomes, I was just in D.C. talking to some people that were in the congressional office that he interns in. So one of the first things he does after becoming a millionaire is he just goes to work as intern in Alan Grayson's office.
Because he wanted to understand how Washington
works? He just wanted to understand the political process. Mm-hmm. He really attacked this notion that you could sort of work within the system and sort of quote unquote hack it in the best possible sense, that you could he had skills that he felt like he could bring that could really make it better.
And then he gets involved in this idea that research and academic journals should be open to everybody, and they're not, even though a lot of these papers are paid for with government funding. And he decides, well, this is wrong, that this information should be public. And that is another turning point.
So this is essentially the heart of the open access movement. We have a very odd sort of situation in our country and academia where researchers are often creating, you know, engaged in this research that is really looking at the kind of big questions of our time scientifically. And when they're done with this research, which is often taxpayer funded, they have to hand over their copyrights to these big kind of publishing companies like JSTOR or Reed Elsevier. And then those companies often scrape the cream off the top. If you go to JSTOR, you have to buy these articles, these publications. And the universities often have to then subscribe to these things. So it's a really odd system in which the researcher doesn't get any sort of monetary payback for what they do. And it really restricts people's access. I mean, if you go to JSTOR, you could spend easily $50, $60, $70 a pop on some of these journals. So this is offensive to the open access movement. And so we don't know why Aaron specifically. There's actually a number of reasons he may have been doing this. But what he does is he begins to download articles at a pretty significant rate from one of these services, which is JSTOR.
And he does that at MIT because he has an account at MIT, which allows him access to JSTOR.
Right. So what Aaron does is he, and again, we don't know what he was going to do with these articles, but what he actually does is he goes onto the MIT network, and from MIT, MIT has access to this database, JSTOR database. And so what he does is he starts downloading articles and ends up downloading 4.7 million academic journal articles. So he's got these in his possession, and MIT takes steps to try to kick him off the network. And at one point they arrest him, but he is arrested before he actually does anything with these articles, which actually becomes a problem later for the prosecutors.
Because he didn't signal an intent to actually sell them for profit or anything like that.
So that takes away
a motive.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a real question about, well, what was he trying to do with 4.7 million academic journal
articles? And he never
told
anyone?
I think he talked to some friends a little bit in confidence about that. But the prosecutors were struggling to understand why anybody would do this. The notion that Aaron could sell these or he's trying to profit from them is pretty silly, I think, to almost anybody that looks at this from the outside. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the 1860 Journal of Botany, right? So the street value is not necessarily that high.
But it fits in with his overall philosophy that he thinks information needs to be free and open to the
public.
Yes.
So the second possibility is he might have just dumped them online somewhere. And that certainly is and is consistent with this open access movement. But the third is that he was doing research on these research articles to look for funding of that research that might have led to biased results. He'd done this before. He did this with the Westlaw legal database, downloaded a bunch of academic journals, studied them for corporate corruption, basically, and never released them. So of those three choices, it's hard. We don't know what he was going to do with them.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Brian Knappenberger. He's the director of a new documentary called The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz. Why was the government so interested in prosecuting him? The federal government, the Justice Department, decided to go full bore and go after him for 13 counts of wire and computer fraud.
Well, it's a really good question. They definitely went after him, and they were very serious about it. They were never going to negotiate in all the kind of plea deals and all the deals that happened. They were never going to agree to anything less than a felony. They told Aaron's dad that they wanted to make an example out of Aaron, that they needed a case for deterrence.
And this was during the WikiLeaks time, right?
Yeah.
And so Anonymous was making itself known in various ways.
I think so. I mean, I think there was, you can't separate his case from the kind of landscape that was happening at the time. This was just, he got arrested just after WikiLeaks releasing the Afghan war logs, the diplomatic cables, Anonymous, a group from Anonymous called PayPal 14. Did denial of service attacks on MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal when those companies cut off financial services to WikiLeaks. Right around when Aaron was arrested was the beginning of the Arab Spring. That year saw unprecedented hacktivist activity, and it ended with Occupy. So the world was on fire, there's no question. And so you can't separate Aaron's story from that backdrop, but you have to, because there's lots of different kinds of activity going on and different intentions and different purposes. And so this kind of looking at academic research and the way that they were going after him is puzzling.
So you didn't talk to the prosecutors for your film?
Nope.
They wouldn't talk to you. But the U.S. attorney who's handling the case said at the time that stealing is stealing, whether you use a computer command or a crowbar, and whether you take documents, data, or dollars.
That's
so
right.
So that's the law. He was caught stealing. And so...
Right. Well, we look at that. Well, first of all, I tried very hard to talk to them. We don't exactly know what their case was going to be. There's no public trial. We don't know what they would have argued. In the film, we basically take a former prosecutor who believes that some of the charges against Aaron were justified, and we let him make the case as best as we can. But yeah, the documents, data, or dollars, crowbar is the same as a computer command, is a silly interpretation of computer laws. It's obviously not true. Crowbar always causes damage. It's not clear where the damage was in this case. And in fact, the main quote-unquote victim of this crime, which is JSTOR, dropped all charges. But the government's case marches on, and MIT collaborates.
So Aaron Swartz didn't feel like he had any other option but to take his own life?
Well, I think we look at that and we talk to people that were close to him in the film who lived with him. Taryn, his girlfriend at the time, lived with Aaron when he took his own life. And we talked to his brothers and people that were close to him and try to understand what all went into that decision. Obviously, it's something that it's difficult to kind of understand where somebody is at that moment. But, and Taryn says that he had some sort of signs of depression, she thinks, in his early 20s, but didn't when he lived with her. But, the trial was a big deal. This was a two-year legal nightmare in which they hounded him. During this 2 years... It's interesting because he's also rallying the troops for political causes, right? He's also being an advocate for the open internet in efforts like the SOPA effort. So he's very vocal and kind of forward, and he's on TV and all of this during that time. But he's obviously going through a kind of private hell at the same time.
As I said at the beginning of this, he's become sort of a martyr. For the hacktivist community, the open internet community. And I'm just wondering, since his death a year and a half ago, what has happened in terms of carrying on his works and his legacy?
Well, a lot of people have picked up where he has left off. It's impossible to replace somebody like him. He was so good at the sort of technical aspects of what he was doing, and at the same time was so good at articulating the kind of political relevance to people who are very not, you know, people that aren't technical. He's obviously missing in the NSA debate. You can see some of probably where he would have been in the group that he co-founded called Demand Progress, other groups like EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, San Francisco. But his presence and his loss is certainly felt.
Brian Knappenberger directed The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz, and it comes out in theaters and it's online tomorrow. Coming up at 1 o'clock, Barbara Bogave is sitting in for Warren Olney with To the Point. She's here now with a preview. Hello.
Hello, Madeline. Today we're talking also about a somber topic. Mm-hmm. It's older workers being left out of the recovery, and specifically a hard-hit group subsection of older workers is middle-aged women, ages 45 to 55. The recession hit them hard. Many left their jobs to care for elderly parents and mm-hmm. that sandwich generation.
Taking care of their kids and their parents at the same time.
Right, and now they can't get back for many reasons, ageism, sexism, just among them.
Okay, looking forward to that at 1 o'clock.
So to speak, yes.
I guess looking forward to it, but an interesting topic nonetheless at 1 o'clock. And Barbara Gave filling in for Warren Olney and To the Point. Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up on this program, are armed drones risking a war that never ends? A new report made up of military and defense experts is critical of the Obama administration's drone policy and has some ideas of how to fix it. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Military drones can fly into dangerous areas and kill enemies of state without ever putting a U.S. pilot in danger. On the surface, drone warfare seems like an ideal way to deal with conflict zones and enemy combatants, but their use is controversial. Hundreds of civilians have been killed, and the entire program is shrouded in secrecy. And now this. A report by the Stimson Center out today finds there's no evidence drone warfare has curbed extremist activity and could actually lead to a state of perpetual war. The Stimson Center is a nonpartisan think tank. And for more, we turn to task force member Janine Davidson. She's a former Air Force pilot and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Well, you found that despite being used for more than 10 years, the use of armed drones has never been thoroughly analyzed in terms of their efficacy, if they're worth it. And does your report attempt to do that?
Well, actually, what our report does is tries to first differentiate between the technology and the strategy. I mean, there are drones that are used for all sorts of things that have incredible value on the battlefield and off the battlefield. But then there's also the use to which we have been putting them recently in the so-called targeted killings counterterrorism strategy, which we also address.
Right. And then that's the part that is obviously the most controversial and the part that you say could lead to a state of perpetual warfare in your report. Can you explain that?
Right. So one of the things we point out is that the targeted killing strategy in general is questionable, whether or not you're using an F-16, which is a fighter jet with a manned pilot, or whether you're using a drone. What makes it concerning and why we think it's gotten so much attention is the perception that the false perception that these drone technologies are necessarily cheaper. They're not necessarily cheaper in terms of money, but that they are less risky in terms of putting our own troops in harm's way, our own pilots in harm's way. And that sense can potentially, we feel, lead people to be using these when they wouldn't have otherwise thought about it. That said, it's not as though we can take this technology and put it back in the box. And it's not as though we're not going to want to use it. We want to use it responsibly, but we want to also ensure that we're going to set norms globally for others that are obviously attempting to get this technology as well.
Well, right, because you address that issue as well in your report, that if we're using it, then other people can use it, and maybe Russia. We've already seen Iran using it in Iraq. And so then the U.S. will not be able to point fingers at others if the U.S. is continuing to use drones in this way.
Well, that's the concern. And so what we're trying to say is, look, every time there's a new technology like this, there's lots of controversy, there's lots of hope, and there's also lots of worry. And we want to make sure that the way in which we're using this technology now does not set precedents, set a trajectory that's global, that will create sort of a new normal about the way we operate in war that we're not comfortable with. And we understand that you know, the United States has a unique position in the world. We're the first mover on this technology, and we have a great deal of influence in the international stage. And so if we don't at least stop, pause, and think through the way in which this technology is being utilized and the way in which it's going to proliferate, and try to get a global community around some difficult norms that need to be formed, then we could wake up one day in a very different world.
Last month, the president addressed this issue at a commencement speech at West Point, and he was discussing counterterrorism drone strikes in Yemen and Somalia. And let's listen to a bit of that.
In taking direct action, we must uphold standards that reflect our values. That means taking strikes only when we face a continuing imminent threat, and only where there is near certainty of no civilian casualties. For our actions should meet a simple test. We must not create more enemies than we take off the battlefield.
So there are two issues in there that I want to address. First, that last one, creating more enemies than we take off the battlefield. What does your report find?
Well, what our report says is that there's reason to believe that this use, not just the use of this technology, but the strategy of targeted killings in general with whatever technology is used, can potentially be backfiring. And what our concern is, and we were a drones task force, not a targeted killings task force, but our concern is that there are not mechanisms in place that allow, number one, transparency, which is part of what the president was talking about. To his credit, that's what they're trying to do, but also to be able to have a no-kidding assessment. You know, what have been the short-term gains, and what are the potential unintended consequences of this strategy? What is the cost benefit? And so what we call for in the report is a process by which this strategy can be assessed right now, but then a continual assessment of our long-term efforts in counterterrorism.
Okay, and you, the unintended consequences you spoke of, and which the president talked about, the civilian casualties. There's an estimate that in Pakistan alone, maybe up to 950 civilians have been killed, as many as 200 children. What did your report say about that?
Right, so there are a lot of conflicting reports, and it comes down to basing whether or not, you know, who you consider a combatant. And the legal scholars on our task force were very concerned about the precedents being set with respect to the laws of war. And the United, as a former military person with a defense background, I mean, the United States military goes to great lengths to avoid civilian casualties. And ironically, one of the benefits of using drones, contrary to popular belief, is that you can actually get a very clear sense of the battlefield. So civilian casualties are going to happen whether you're using drones or whether you're using F-16s. We did not find necessarily that the use of drones increases casualties. What we're concerned with is the targeted killings in general, and the fact that maybe drones make them more likely to be launched. And so that is a concern, because to the extent that there are more civilian casualties happening because we're targeting more terrorists, or if there is a perception that there are more civilian casualties, that could potentially have a negative backlash against the United States that could create more motivations for terrorists.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
That's Janine Davidson, former Air Force pilot, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, a contributor to a new report out today by the Stimson Center on drones. And you can also read the recommendations at their website. And joining us now, as she does every day at this time, Jolie Myers with The Mail. Hello.
Happy Thursday to you, Madeline.
Thank you. You too.
So I'm going to start where we started today, the soccer game in which we lost and won. A few jokes from Twitter from our listeners and for our listeners. Turns out you can win for losing, number one. I don't always play soccer, but when I do, I both win and lose. And my personal favorite, which is less of a joke and more of an observation that I agree with, soccer as a sport has many, many problems, but I'm willing to overlook them all because games don't go over 2 hours. I feel the same about movies.
Yeah.
Don't take more than 2 hours of my time. It's just a little presumptuous, I think.
Right, and not a lot of commercial breaks, so you can just breeze through it.
Right, exactly. So we talked about movies too today, Runaway Production, in which LA is the clear loser. Listener Barda called in. Let's hear what she had to say.
I just wanted to point out that productions also employ florists and drivers and designers, restaurants, hotels, caterers, shops, costumers, medics, police, accountants, etc. So there's a lot of people who get employment from production.
Yeah, and a listener, Tori, called in as well. She's a makeup artist, and she's seen most of her business move to Canada. And she said she would love to move her family up there, but they have all their ties down here, and she just can't afford to make the move. So looks like LA is kind of on the losing end for now.
All right. Thank you very much, Jolie Myers, bringing the mail. If you'd like to weigh in on anything you hear on the air, you are more than welcome to. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or a comment on our Facebook page or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Barbara Bogave is in for Warren Olney up at 1 o'clock with To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.